An IBM, I forget what model machine, it takes about 4 or 6 hours to compress a frame. It's all done in software to begin with. And, IBM came out with the first chipset with 3 giant chips that would actually do it in real time. So we've come a long way from that.
I agree, Eric. We have come a long way, and we don't know when or if we're going to hit a glass ceiling. My gut feeling is we're going to hit a gut ceiling. We're going to hit a glass ceiling with our present semiconductor technology because quantum mechanics is going to out. But we might figure some other quantum mechanically based method of getting away with smaller or faster processing. Who knows? Only time will tell.
Well, we have quantum computing, we have optical computing, we have a whole bunch of other things. It's a matter of speed. The math stays the same. The math gets more complicated. There's more operations per unit in terms of being able to do things. I mean, we do discrete cosine transforms at 56 bits. We did it at 128 bits. It's going to double or triple the amount of processing time that you need. And either you make the processing time the processor faster, or you wait until it gets done during it a longer period of time, which takes you away from real time. So there you go. Enough of it.
Well, you know, as far as you can go with quantum computers is an intriguing field. The problem is that you can't just slap general computer algorithms into a quantum computer. There are certain algorithms suited for a quantum computer where you can try a multitude of solutions as a superposition and then collapse it and find the right one. So they'll probably be great for finding prime numbers. But I think if you tried to have them do a cosine transform, I think they would choke on something like that. But I might be wrong. But quantum computers are amazing things, but they are limited in the scope of what problems they can solve. The problems they can solve theoretically, if you get the qubits up to a high enough number, they can do it very fast. But there are a lot of forms of algorithms that don't translate well into quantum computers.
Oh, I agree with you completely. It's the closest thing that we have, but you can almost make a direct relationship, is how we do DSP, which is based on Harvard architecture, which is actually multiple strings of memory doing basically multiply and accumulate. That's all you have to do. You can be able to multiply long strings and add. So, you know, we're not that far away from that. There's a lot of ways of substituting. I mean, I can think of going back into the 80s, these big boxes that we had that were just, fast Fourier transforms. These were whole big hardware boxes to do that series of multiplication. And we're looking at the same thing. I mean, the math stays the same, the hardware changes.
Yeah, I mean, math is much more difficult to move away from. You might be able to find little mathematical tricks to save yourself some steps in the algorithm, but math is math. Hardware, thankfully, we live in a time where hardware changes much faster than any mathematical theory progresses. So, yeah, at this point, it's all hardware-driven, which is fine because it's going at a rather fast clip. That's why it's going to be sad if it slows down or worse if it stops.
Yeah, well, you look at IBM, you look at the truly fast Fourier FFT, and you'll find that the amount of years that they spent making it incredibly fast, and it's just in the mathematical domain, and it's like they've reached the plateau. And you come up with faster hardware, but it ain't that much faster.
Okay, I mean, when I was in college, I was using, I think it was a PDP-8 running fast Fourier algorithm. So, at the time, it was great. Probably, nowadays, you could do a lot better. I remember the price of the memory chips for those things. It was back in the bad old days. My first computer was 48K of memory, and it was fully loaded. It was about as big and heavy as you could build it. And, nowadays, you can't even get a thumbstick that has 48K of memory.
Yeah, that's my first. My first computer, I had access to it back in like the 780s, and everything was CD211 CD223, portable things. And, you know, we had them hooked up to the National Frame Buffers, and that's how we did computer graphics. And, you know, we were doing openings, and I worked with New York Institute of Technology, we were doing openings for all these different shows. It only takes, you know, 60, 80 minutes, 120 minutes frame to get a version, and we just, you know, either put them down on a frame of film or record a single frame of video on a Sony 2500, which would actually do a single frame recording with full bandwidth, or a Dycomed, and you're recording 14 and play 14. We do those things now, but in a different way, much faster. You know, time marches on, what can I say?
Yes, Rich. W2BZ, you wanted to say something, Rich?
In terms of your topic about media and Blu-ray sales and all that stuff, you know, I was thinking, as we're pretty spoiled here on Long Island and the metropolitan area. I mean, we probably got the biggest bandwidth capability in the country. But what about rural Tennessee? I mean, can they watch 4K, Eric, do you know, as easily as we can, you know, streaming-wise? Go ahead.
Is that directed at me?
That was a question for you, Eric.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch it. Repeat it for me.
We're very spoiled here on, you know, in the metropolitan area about being able to stream at phenomenal rates. But do you know in the rest of the country, of rural Tennessee, if they can get the same streaming quality as we can here?
Yeah, how depends upon who your ISP is. Today most of your internet connects are at 256 or 512. Between ISPs, yeah, it's possible. Don't forget, when we stream 4K, we're compressing the garbage out of it. And in a lot of places where you get bottlenecks, basically you wind up buffering and stuff. You can get a whole 4K program into a box just by streaming it and collect it in real time and play it in real time. So, I mean, there's lots of different streams where the places are where they don't have the bandwidth or the infrastructure doesn't support it. You can play things like that. So, yeah, you can get 4K anywhere you want.
That's good enough. About 300 movies, over 300 movies on DVD. But I hardly touch them. You know, it's so much easier to stream stuff, you know, and pick from a menu on your TV than go in and open the case and take the DVD out and put it in, you know what I mean? So I find myself going to my DVD collection a lot less.
Yeah, well, I understand that. But, you know, there is a reality of having the hard disk and random access. Well, all right, I want to watch 15 minutes of this now. I've got to go do something else. I want to come back and I'll watch the next 15 minutes, so on and so forth. Or I want to jump to the middle of it. And with the streaming, a lot of streaming facilities don't give you that ability. Also, the interactive stuff that you get on the DVD, you're not going to get in the streaming world, and you're not interested in the director's cut or those kinds of things that you would find on DVD, you know. I mean, if you're a movie aficionado, you want that stuff. If you're just watching a movie, who cares?
That's very true, and I don't think streaming, well, they'll have all that stuff streaming, too. Right? As long as those companies keep your eyeball on a screen, they'll do anything for that. So, boy, this new age sure has come on fast. That's all I can say. W2BZ.
All right, I gotta step out of here, gentlemen.
Continue on. Okay, thank you very much, Eric, and thanks, Rich. I realize that the manufacturers that produce these DVDs add features to entice people. and it became generically required to have people who produced shows and such have audio, separate audio tracks playing to do discussions of what went into the production. And some of these guys apparently had to do it under so much duress that I still remember a DVD with the commentary channel being basically them playing video games in the background. They had so much disdain for that extra feature on the DVD. So it depends. If you really like the extra features, yes, you have to buy the DVD, or I don't think you can even rent them anymore, so you'd have to buy the DVD. Most people don't really care for any of that. They just want to watch something and eat some popcorn, and for them, streaming is a wonderful way of doing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But, you know, there's features like multiple actors, a movie that was shot with multiple cameras, it's kind of a rare thing, but you get the ability to look at every angle with the camera, with the pointing, even though it's not part of the final cut. But there's lots of neat features that nobody talks about, but then again, just watch the movie.
Yes, I agree, but they're trying similar tricks even to this day. There was a movie made by the people who produced Black Mirror, the anthology series called Bandersnatch, and the concept was that you went on Netflix and you chose paths in the movie, making decisions where the characters would go. So it was a kind of a branched, almost game-like movie experience where you could interact with the characters and make decisions for them. So they're still trying to play those little games because they want people to be involved and somewhat participatory in the process, and they think that that's a good venue. I think people enjoyed Bandersnatch, but I don't know if there's going to be much more in that vein going on.
You're absolutely right, Roy, you know, I've heard some writers and directors, you know, who sounded like they pain doing these, narrations. And I, who was, you know, in the business and interested in that stuff, and every film student, that's one thing, but I think that's going to be going away real quick unless the streaming people find out that they can make more money over that, and I don't think they can. W2BZ.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Rich. I don't think there's any money in doing it. You won't have people buying a streaming service that has secondary audio tracks. It was a feature that kind of peaked around, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, and at this point, it's more of a drudgery that a lot of people. Sometimes they invite their friends to just BS on the audio tracks. And like I said, the most absurd version of this was the guys playing a video game in the background. There was no one talking. You just heard the sound effects and things blowing up as they played their video game. That was their little way of saying, you know, we don't want to do this audio track. So, yeah, I think that it came and went like 3D television. You know, the industry tries things, they throw stuff on the wall, some of it sticks, but most of it slides down into the ground.
You know, one thing that's like most of it is the tours that they have to go on to sell their movies. They're really selling the movie to the distributor, and the public is sort of secondary. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in terms of they hire companies to do the sales. They hire companies to do all the promotional stuff to try and sell the movie.
I agree, Eric. I mean, we're all kind of blissfully unaware of the economy, you know. Again, this is a billion-dollar industry, multi-billion-dollar industry, and there are promoters. There are all kinds of in-between guys. Recently on YouTube, I saw an interesting, it was an hour-long story of the making of the film Clerks. And what they went through to get it to distributors, and how difficult it was to get Miramax to sign on, and they had to kind of find people to talk to the guy running Miramax, and and put him in a position where he had to watch the film. And it was a fascinating documentary on the subject, and only goes to show that this is all a business of making money and such, and you got to know the right people, like anything else in business.
No, that's absolutely correct. I used to be involved in some of that stuff years ago. Well, I keep doing the same thing. Goodbye. See you guys later. Sure you do, Jeff.
Okay, Doug. Thanks, Eric. Does anyone else have any questions or comments about this topic? Otherwise, I'll move on to the next one. Okay. Well, you know, we've talked about personal quadcopters and drones a few times before here, and the FAA has had a confusing history of slapping changing regulations all over the place for the past few years, with the help of the judiciary branch overthrowing many of these instituted rules. Well, they're about to do it all over again. Drone owners will soon need to display their device registration numbers on the outside of their craft. The Federal Aviation Administration has declared this. The agency, which last month proposed looser restrictions on drone night flights, posted the rule on a Federal Register preview site. The directive is set to take effect on February 23rd. You'll need to mark the ID number on your drone's body by then. The FAA created its mandatory drone registration program in 2015, though a court struck it down in May 2017. Registration regulations were reinforced later that year when the National Defense Authorization Act for 2018 became law. When the FAA initially established the program, it said drone owners could house the ID number within the battery compartment as long as tools weren't required to open it. Let me drop for a second. The new measure is coming into place to help law enforcement and security offices identify drone owners easier and faster. The FAA wrote in the Federal Register filing that officials from other agencies were concerned about the risk of a concealed explosive device poses to the first responders who must open a compartment to find the small unmanned aircraft's registration number. The FAA said it was able to enforce the rule without first seeking public comment because of a clause in the Administrative Procedure Act. It claimed that had it simply proposed the rule at first responders could be exposed to additional risks during the notice and comment period as a result of the attention drawn to the vulnerability. So, you'll still have 30 days to submit comments on the rule after it's published in the Federal Registry this coming Wednesday, but put your ID on the outside, because otherwise you'll get a ticket. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2ES.
Who's writing the ticket? A cop?
I don't know. It's an FAA regulation. Do cops ticket people with FAA regulations, or do they ask the FAA to come by and do the honors?
I'm at 10-1-YDY.
And wouldn't do it if they were told to do it, probably. Run out in the field and chase some kid with a drone. But, last I looked, the FAA didn't have enough personnel in the field to run around the country giving tickets.
Comment, 10-1-YDY.
Yes, Hank, please, comment.
Only an FAA carrier inspector or a gate inspector has the legal authority to write a citation, which is actually a notice of investigation, for an FAR. So technically a policeman in any jurisdiction, including federal, is not capable of writing a ticket unless they've got a special law that says so, because they have had cases in the past where they've had policemen try to write pilot speeding tickets and things like that on airport surfaces, and that's all been dismissed.
I wonder, though, if this might build impetus among large city-state legislatures of enacting similar regulations on a city or state level as well.
Well, I can tell you that if the FAA has got the jurisdiction, then no city and no state has the jurisdiction. It's a federal preemption, and that's something that's been successfully fought in courts, even here in New York State, when the town of Brookville or village of Brookville tried to write the state of New York a ticket for noise violation when they landed a helicopter in a field in in Jericho, Brookville, actually, Brookville Village.
Okay, Hank, thanks for the information. It strikes me that the FAA is doomed with all these drone regulations that they keep coming up with, because it seems to me so difficult that they could make them stick anywhere. I mean, they can occasionally assault the odd fellow who probably flies a drone into an airport, which is our next little short story. You know, with those, I guess they'll get special attention. But otherwise, I think it's going to be the wild, wild west still.
Well, the big thing is, sir, that if they happen to find you, and then they proceed to find you, the penalties are significantly greater. They come in multiples of $12,500. So the first offense is a $12,500, and then it can go up 2, 3, 4 times that.
Okay, they didn't really give the price of the penalty, but again, my guess is going to be these are going to be few and far between, because I think people aren't terribly clever, but I think they'll figure out to stay as far away from airports as possible, and probably if you stay away from airports, you probably won't get involved with the FAA too much, but I might be wrong. Either way, I think it would be wise to simply put your ID on the outside of your little drone.
Have to agree, but I'm sure that there's somebody who will proceed to fly into a airport traffic area or other designated airspace and get himself in trouble. And of course, you always have that thing that happened in England right around the holidays where they suspected drone flights and they shut down Heathrow for a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be some guy who has no common sense whatsoever. That's the nature of humanity. Okay, the second half of this little story is, if you don't believe that drones aren't a nuisance and a threat at times, recently, Dubai International Airport was shut down and all flights were grounded for roughly 30 minutes recently after a drone was spotted in the area. Dubai Media Office reported on a Twitter. It was the latest airport shutdown in what's becoming a troubling pattern of drone sightings around the globe. Dubai Airport confirms that the operation at Dubai International are back to normal after less than 30 minutes of delay due to unauthorized drone activity, according to the Dubai Media Office tweeted. The airport was shut down from 10:13 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. local time, according to Business Insider. Dubai International, in the United Arab Emirates, is the third busiest airport in the world, apparently, when measured by number of passengers, right behind Peking Capital International Airport and the world's busiest Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta. Over 88 million passengers fly through Dubai International every year. The past few months have seen a number of airports shutting down for various periods of time in response to drone sightings. Flights were grounded at Newark Liberty Airport on January 22nd, 2019, at Heathrow, as Hank said, Heathrow Airport in the United Kingdom on January 8th, 2019, and at Gatwick Airport in the United Kingdom on December 20th and 21st, 2018. Over 1,000 flights were canceled at Gatwick, causing disruptions for over 140,000 passengers. Let me drop for a second. Authorities in all three locations still have no idea who is behind the drone flights, and in the case of Gatwick Airport, some authorities have questioned whether there was a drone at all. The only thing we know for sure is that even the rumor of a drone in the vicinity can devastate air travel, something we take for granted as part of modern life in the 21st century. Planes can't safely take off and land when there are drones around due to the possibility of collision. There are laws around the world against flying hobby drones too closely to airports and airplanes, and airports have started to take anti-drone protection measures more seriously after the relatively small aircraft caused such serious disruptions. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
One Whitey Wire again with a comment.
Yes, certainly, Hank.
You know, the reason we're having so many drone laws being enacted is that the major manufacturers, essentially Boeing, have done some data and testing on this, and they've discovered that a drone strike to the windscreen at normal traffic pattern approach speed, so basically between 150 to 250 knots, will almost guarantee a windscreen failure with the corresponding damage to the pilot, as well as an engine failure should it be ingested, as compared to the infamous frozen chicken tests that are what they use for damage to either engine or windscreens in the same speed range.
The problem I would have is drones come in kind of all shapes and sizes and weights classes, so that seems to be a kind of a generalization. There's got to be some kind of a particular scale that they're looking at drones at, right? I mean, because drones, drones go anywhere from these little toys that are a couple of inches in diameter that little children play around with in their home to these big industrial monsters.
You're absolutely right, and what they used was a standard from 5 years ago for the size of drone that was required in order to lift a video camera capable of telemetry as opposed to being some type of recording on board. And I forget the exact set of standards, but my understanding is, and again, I'm not a drone guy, is that the size of the drone that was used for this testing is already obsolete, that you can get the same capabilities in a much smaller drone. But the drone that they used for the testing back 5 years ago, which is a set of numbers that are coming forward now, was fairly large to accommodate a video camera and a telemetry set so you could download in real time what the camera was seeing.
Yeah, I was afraid of something like that. 5 years is probably something like three generations of drones. I mean, you can go through a catalog book and see the incredible difference from 5 years ago to these days of the feature set and the higher power capability of the motor systems and the intelligence built in and all manner of things. Today's drone looks fairly nothing like the five-year-old versions of themselves. Okay, so much for drones. Unless anyone has any questions or comments, I'll move on to the next subject. Okay, a few months ago, I spoke about an unknown asteroid crater that was found at the bottom of a patch of ice in Greenland. Well, they found another one. 114 miles away from the first one, they discovered that an even larger one under an area of ice in Greenland. It will be the 22nd largest asteroid crater found on Earth. After the announcement of the first crater discovery last year, scientists went sifting through data in hopes of finding more craters hiding beneath Greenland's ice. They found another potential crater over 22 miles in diameter. It brought up quite a few questions. How many impact craters are hidden beneath the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet? And what do they tell us about the past of geologic history? And how are they interacting with the ice today? Airborne radar surveys of Greenland first revealed the 19-mile-wide Hiawatha impact crater, thought to have originated from an asteroid strike sometime between 12,000 and 3 million years ago. The data revealed another circular depression near Hiawatha. When scientists looked a little closer, it showed all the signs of yet another crater, a little wider and about half as deep as the first one. If the new crater is indeed an impact crater, it's hard to say how old it is. It lies beneath the ice at least 79,000 years old, so that probably is the minimum age, and given the erosion caused by the waxing and waning of the glacier itself, it's probably not older than 2.6 million years. Let me drop for a second. As for the name, the scientists suggested naming the crater the Patterson Crater, after Stan Patterson, a glaciologist who made one of the earliest known ground-based journeys to this region in Greenland. The Patterson Crater is forming nearly simultaneously, according to the paper published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, but their proximity is a plausibility, not conclusively. Explained by chance, they said, bolstered in part by their different shapes and the older ice on top of Patterson. There's plenty of mystery surrounding this depression, including whether it's a crater at all. Unlike Hiawatha, the Patterson Crater is beneath 2 kilometers of ice, making it far more difficult to study and to gather the recrystallized rock that would result from a large impact. But it demonstrates once again that there are geological mysteries sitting beneath glaciers and makes you wonder whether there are more massive impact craters waiting to be found. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GI. Okay, on to the next. Scientists are dreaming up ways to probe the nature of the universe's smallest bit, quarks, by observing ultra-dense neutron stars slamming into each other. Particle colliders in Switzerland and on Long Island, New York, have each seen evidence of a whole new form of matter in which quarks, rather than atoms, are the basic unit. But scientists think that neutron star collisions should also produce this kind of matter and think that they might be able to spot it using gravitational wave detectors. Matter is typically composed of atoms, which are in turn made from electrons, protons, and neutrons. These protons and neutrons are themselves made of quarks, but at high enough energies and pressures, matter goes a phase transition into something called quark matter or quark gluon plasma, in which the constituent parts of protons and neutrons, the quarks, are no longer confined to the atom and become the smallest component of matter. Typically, scientists create quark matter in colliders by slamming atoms together at high energies, but you'd think that the incredible energies of colliding neutron stars, stellar corpses as massive as the sun but only a few miles across, would create this kind of matter as well. Let me drop for a second. Scientists announced the first recorded instance of 2 neutron stars slamming together in August 2017, which we talked about, which an event witnessed via the ripples in space-time called gravitational waves that they produce. 2 new papers published this past week in Physical Review Letters use computer simulations to predict 2 potential ways to observe something like quark matter produced during neutron star collisions, based on how it affects the gravitational wave signal. One paper from researchers in Germany proposed that the colliding neutron stars would present a differently shaped gravitational wave signal with a different phase after the neutron stars merge than theory otherwise predicts. This would be the result of quark matter forming somewhat gradually throughout the collision before the whole system collapses into one big black hole. Another paper from an international team of researchers suggested that the collision immediately forms the core of quark matter at the center. This would cause the gravitational waves to oscillate with higher than expected frequencies after the merger. Both research teams have the same requirements. In order to make their observations, they need upgrades at the gravitational wave observatories like the US-based LIGO and the Europe-based Virgo. Basically, we need a higher sensitivity of detectors at high frequencies, and we need for status. These events would need to be as close, if not closer, than the August 2017 event, which took place 40 megaparsecs, which is approximately 130 million light years away from Earth. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Yes, Rich.
I seem to recall them, scientific community talking about creating gravitational wave detectors in space using satellites. Has there been any progress on that? WB2GXM.
Okay, I just wanted to have the repeater's ad run. Yes, there's a lot of theory and planning that's going on. because if you can build something to the right specifications in space, you can make them much more distant and thereby more sensitive. So they're in the planning stage. There's no information of when something like that will be up and running. It took decades for us to fine-tune and get the LIGO running up to spec, so it might not be as simple as it sounds. But that's the plan for the future. The larger, the longer the right-angle interferometers, the more sensitive the equipment will be able to be made. Any other questions or comments for this subject? Okay, very well. A newly approved NASA mission is called SPHEREx, and it will use a space-based observatory to study the early conditions of the universe and hunt celestial ingredients required for life. Proposed way back in 2016, and this is a long one, the Spectrophotometer for the History of the Universe, Epoch of Reionization and ICE's Explorer Mission, or thankfully shortened to SPHEREx for short, was chosen by NASA from eight other proposed missions because, quote, it offered the best science potential and the most feasible development plan, end quote. In the words of the space agency, the orbital observatory will survey space both visible and for astronomers. The two-year, $242 million mission, excluding launch costs, could be up and running as early as 2023. Caltech astronomer James Bach will serve as the project's principal investigator. Other partners for the project include NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Korea Astronomy and Space Science Institute, and Colorado's Ball Aerospace. SPHEREx will be used to analyze more than 300,000 galaxies, including ones as far as 10 billion light years away. Accordingly, the observatory will peer back, far back into cosmological time, allowing astronomers to catch a glimpse of the early universe. SPHEREx will deliver an unprecedented galactic map containing fingerprints from the first moments of the universe's history. It will provide new clues to one of the greatest mysteries in science. What made the universe expand so quickly, less than a nanosecond after the Big Bang? Let me drop for a second. Astronomers will also be using SPHEREx to study the millions of stars within the Milky Way galaxy, using it to search for the fundamental building blocks of life, such as water and organic molecules. Regions in which stars form from dense clouds of gas and dust will also be studied, along with protoplanetary disks, where planets form around young stars. SPHEREx will complete surveys of space in six-month increments. This data will be used to create maps of the cosmos in 96 different color bands, far more than previous efforts. The mission will also do some groundwork in preparation for future space telescopes, such as NASA's James Webb Space Telescope and Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, by flagging candidates, objects worthy of further information. Further observations, rather. SPHEREx will provide four In addition to allowing for comparative analysis of the object studied, the observatory will likely be used to corroborate data from other telescopes in the event of unexpected celestial phenomena, such as supernova explosions. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2IN on the subject before this one, Rory.
Paul, what about?
Yes, the other fellow was asking about experiments that have been done in space or are going to be done in space, and you have the LISA project that European Space Agency is working on. First you had LISA Pathfinder, and that went up, three or four years ago, and spent a year or so testing to see the sensitivity of an instrument that they would be able to use to detect gravitational waves. And since that worked out, it looks like around 10 years from now, by the time they launch these things, they're going to launch three leases, experimentation. They'll put them 1 million miles apart, triangulate gravitational waves. It'll be put into heliocentric orbit. So, you know, they're working on it. Mostly European Space Agency than us. Back to you, Roy.
Well, thank you, Paul. Good for them. I don't mind. I'm glad for places like CERN when we dropped the ball in building an accelerator in Texas and they picked up and ran with it. As long as someone in the human race is looking into the future, you know, I don't really care one way or the other, the nationality, unless they use it for weaponry or what have you. You got to be amazed by the required specifications for these gravitational wave detecting interferometers. They have to be able to measure a difference in space due to the gravitational wave that amounts to a minuscule fraction of the diameter of a neutron. I mean, that strikes me as incredible. How do you possibly do that when your objects are floating in free space? But, you know, science comes up with all kinds of tricks.
Yeah, well, they did that successfully with these two weights that were 19 inches apart, I think it was, inside of a spacecraft. And the spacecraft was, you know, set up where it wouldn't be affected by light coming from the sun or cosmic rays or solar wind, and they compensated for that. And NASA did have part of it. They made these micro thrusters which kept these two weights perfectly stable in the orbit around the sun. They sent it out to the L1 position, the Lagrange 1 point, so you know, 1.5 million kilometers out away from us. So and apparently it worked out. So they'll take that and they're going to run with it. And like I said, I thought I remember reading 2033 even, so it's a long way off to develop this. But, I mean, that's their plan. They'll be able to hear the lower frequency gravity waves that we're not getting. We tend to get them at a higher frequency now. But, hey, at least we got them from LIGO. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, it's fascinating what we've already discerned from the gravitational wave detectors. I hope this space-based one scales up reasonably well without too much technological headaches. I wouldn't say they're racing towards it, though, at a rate of, you know, 13 years from now. They're walking comfortably, towards it, but I wouldn't quite phrase it as racing towards it, but yeah. I have said from way back 2017 that gravitational wave detection is going to be the same importance as radio wave astronomy and optical astronomy. The more different ways to look upon the universe, the more of the secrets will hopefully be revealed to us, and the more we'll be able to figure out what the heck's going on out there.
Okay, well, I know they're on the right track, but it's probably money, you know. You know, money is going to solve this problem of time. You know, if they get more money, maybe they could push it up. But right now, it worked good. They expected one particular result, and they said it was 5 times more sensitive than they expected. So that was a good sign. All right, I'll let you continue. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2N.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you very much. Well, it's always a combination, in my experiences, of money and the technology hasn't quite matured as much as they'd like it to. So it's probably an equal measure of both of those. If anyone has any questions or comments on this or previous subjects, tell me now, or I'll move on to what will probably be my final little ditty. Very well. No doubt you've been reading dire predictions from technologically savvy pundits of the dangers of being taken over by a malevolent artificial intelligence. Well, not to worry. The present administration sort of has you covered. President Donald Trump signed an executive order recently creating something called the American AI Initiative. The executive order is apparently a symbolic nod to artificial intelligence that doesn't create any new funding, but encourages the federal government to do more with artificial intelligence. The executive order will seek to redirect existing funding, but it's not quite clear where that funding will be redirected from. We're excited to be developing principles and an agenda with American values in mind, one of the anonymous Trump administration officials told the Wall Street Journal. That is something we are excited to share with the world. This executive order is about ensuring continued American leadership in AI, which includes ensuring AI technologies reflect American values, policies, and priorities, an anonymous official told Axios. AI is something that touches every aspect of people's lives. What this initiative attempts to do is to bring all those together under one umbrella and show the promise of this technology for the American people, another anonymous Trump administrator told Reuters. So, rest assured, your concerns about artificial intelligence threats are going to be sort of, kind of, taken care of. Maybe. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Repeater, timeout.
Yes, Sam.
Stretch.
Isn't this the one where they're going to take malevolent AI and throw it against their wall?
I don't know, Rich. Politicians work in mysterious ways, and executive orders are probably not worth the paper that they're scribbled on. So this is probably a lot of nothing. Continue to be worried about artificial intelligence if you were worried about it before, and don't worry about it if you weren't worried about it before, because this thing didn't change anything. I just thought it would be amusing, but I don't know. I don't know what to make of these dire threats of artificial intelligence. I sort of get the sense that too many people have read reasonably good science fiction books, or they've seen The Terminator one too many times. I don't know what the future is as far as artificial intelligence, and is there any particular reason why they should be so inherently belligerent towards us? So I'm unsure. It makes for a great plot device. I don't know if the future requires that much fear on our part, but who knows?
CMQ, tell us.
At CMQ.
KC2CMQ, just quick comments there. AI created by us and can only be like us, and we're naughty.
Well, possibly, but I think that's taking a little bit of the Bible too literally. I mean, that we would form artificial intelligence in our own image. I don't think we're smart enough to do it quite that easily. Right now, artificial intelligence is more about self-learning. So you set different tasks for it and then let it experiment, find successful pathways, and establish connections for those pathways. So far in the literature, I have not read of anyone suggesting an id and an ego and a superego and emotions and primitive drives and all the things that kind of get knotted up in our poor minds and cause us to make very silly and dangerous decisions.
I believe Google already had an AI they had to shut down because they went naughty.
There's a big difference between a faulty program that does the wrong thing or learns the wrong thing because they've sent weights of values for different results in a poorly chosen way. So, you know, they'll either do things that they don't want done, or they'll let stand stuff that they wanted them to detect and stop. So I think there's a big quantum leap between poorly designed, poorly operated artificial intelligence and evil geniuses who want to take over the world. But, you know, what do I know? I'm not a science fiction writer. Anyway, it's almost 11 o'clock and time for the space report. I want to thank everyone once again for participating in this science talk, and I'll be back next week with some more things to talk about. If you have any questions or comments or want to refute anything or argue, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All the articles that I've mentioned today and the images of School Ultima will be available on roy.ac2gs.com, in addition to a link that Paul wanted me to put up for the space report, so take a look at that as well. And I want to thank everyone again for participating, and thank Paul and Dick. So back to you, Dick, so you can hand it off to Paul.
Thank you, Roy. I think a few of the subjects you discussed tonight were not necessarily on the list that you sent to me and Paul for the last 2 days. Is that true?
I just substituted one because on my original list I had a news item that Paul was going to cover in his space report. So I ejected that one, and I inserted the Samsung stopping from producing Blu-ray players in the U.S. So that was the only change on the list.
Blu-ray was a good subject. We got quite a bit of mileage out of that one. Paul's next. And Paul, I'm trying to see your message of, yes, the Mars One project apparently has been canceled. I don't remember reading about that. Way back August 30, 2015, apparently we were discussing the Mars One project, which was a one-way project. In other words, by way of Elon Musk and booster companies like that, some number of people were going to be sent to Mars on the assumption they never come back. But from my point of view, getting them there alive and having them enjoy the process is a far fetch. And if you're not self-sustaining, if you can't grow your own food on Mars, I don't think you're going to live there very long. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why growing food on Mars is going to be a hell of a lot more difficult than that movie that we saw recently called The Martian. So where was it announced that Mars One project has officially been canceled, Paul? I didn't remember reading that. WS2N, with the latest space report, which is something like space report number 334, but maybe it's a higher number than that. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good. Yeah, I got 335. Yeah, I have to keep it like that. Otherwise, if I go back to, you know, if I put something in for search, I'll wind up going to a wrong website if I change it. Wrong document. Yeah, Mars One, in Europe, it was discussed, you know, this guy, his name is Bas Landstrom. He comes from the Netherlands, and they wound up on the, I think they tried to get on the Frankfurt stock market. But nevertheless, about 2012 he started, and he was going to have this great system where we were going to be landing people on Mars by 2022, 2023. And then he kept pushing it back to 2028 and 2030. And meanwhile, I think he was taking people's money for these applications. So, you know, if you go back to 3.5 years ago, I have it as net 164, August 30th, 2015. I guess you could listen to amateur radio Tango Victor. Listen to those conversations, and the weeks after, one of those weeks, I remember saying this is probably a scam. I would keep away from it. And sure enough, that's the way it looks now. This guy is kind of like dropping out of sight, him and his partner. And I knew it was going to be a problem. He thought he was going to get there with $6 billion that he didn't have. He was going to raise $6 billion. He never got that far. Some people sent him money. 200,000 applications in each application. There was a fee when you filed for it. So, yeah, it was going to be a one-way trip. I knew that was going to work out. But yet, you had people signing up for it. But at he wanted to do it for $6 billion. Now, if you go back to the NASA program, that in today's money would be over $100 billion. Just to develop the Apollo program. This guy was going to go all the way to Mars, plant four people on Mars to start, not come back, set up living quarters and everything, all for $6 billion. So when they started telling me that, I started reading about applications and $30,000 to get involved and $3,000 for a piece of paper, whatever it was, you'll probably find on one of those amateur TV reports me saying that this is probably a scam. I think it was. So yeah, they went bankrupt. Any other questions, Dick?
Yeah, I do remember at the time discussing that growing food is very difficult. You have no air pressure on Mars. Plants will not grow with no air pressure. And the process of creating the air pressure and having enough window area to let in enough sunlight to grow the plants, the main self-sustaining food, very difficult. Oh, you both get your eyes on it.
Yeah, I agree. And people were all fired up about this worldwide. And I think China told it that people don't send money to this guy. And, you know, I think they caught on. But he collected money from people around the world, including I think somebody from Long Island. So I remember it was a Newsday. So they were getting down to their last couple of hundred candidates, and they were going to have a reality show. It was going to all be shown, recorded day to day as they were living on Mars, and it was going to be shown back here, and it was going to be all kinds of money coming in for that. Really bizarre. So let the buyer beware with these get rich quick schemes that are coming out there. It's not like NASA. You know, we pay taxes into NASA, and eventually the money is decided by the people of where it's going to go, not some guy that's coming up with some scheme to send people on a one-way trip. That's crazy. So, but yet people were signing up for it, like I said before. Okay. I don't know if anybody saw Nova last week on Channel 21 or the previous week on Channel 13, The Rise of the Rockets.
I've seen that. Very well done.
Yeah, it's almost like they listened to the SpaceNet report, and they must have covered every rocket that we've discussed here. You know, I mean, they covered the Starliner by Boeing that's going to be carrying people to the International Space Station. They covered the Crew Dragon version that's going to also be carrying four people at a time eventually to the space station by SpaceX. One right after the other. Blue Origin, they mentioned, they talked about the New Glenn. Well, that hasn't flown yet. They talked about the launcher by Orbital Galactic. That's the one where he took one of his old planes. When I said Richard Branson, he took an old 747 passenger plane and converted it into a carrier jet, and he's going to put a rocket on the left wing, the port wing, and drop it from a height and have it go into space. And it looks like he's getting ready for about a launch, probably within about a month or so, a test launch. It's getting there. Let me drop this. So that show covered him. They covered Rocket Lab. They showed the launch facility that he has at Rocket Lab. The seller, Peter Beck, another billionaire that built that's building the Electron rocket. And they showed the launch facility, and they showed a rocket going off. But they didn't say where it was, but that was in the North Island of New Zealand, originally from that location. But, you know, it's registered with the United States. He just happened to think that that was going to be a good launch facility. And he's going to be eventually launching, you know, on a